Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. When the four remaining members of the Grateful Dead recently announced plans to play one last time this July, bass player Phil Lesh said, quote, "It is with respect and gratitude that we reconvene the Dead one last time to celebrate not merely the band's legacy, but also the community that we've been playing to and with for 50 years," end quote. So far, over 350,000 tickets have been requested, and 44,000 hotel rooms are already booked in Chicago for this three-day series of shows in July. For almost three decades, the Grateful Dead was America's most popular touring band. The Dead community is obviously still thriving two decades after the band's dissolution. So why? That's the simple question today's guest, Peter Richardson, asks in his new book, No Simple Highway, A Cultural History of the Grateful Dead. He writes, quote, "The Grateful Dead's status as counterculture heroes masks an even more important source of their popularity. Although they offered a fully formed alternative to America's sober, God-fearing, and profit-maximizing ways, a large part of their appeal arose not from their resistance to American culture, but rather from their uncanny ability to tap its inexhaustible utopian energies," end quote. Peter Richardson teaches humanities and American studies at San Francisco State University. His new book is No Simple Highway, A Cultural History of the Grateful Dead. He's also author of A Bomb in Every Issue, and that recounts the rise and fall of Ramparts magazine. And Peter joins me in studio. Hi, Peter. Thanks for coming
Rose.
In.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you. So first off, for listeners who aren't Deadheads or maybe don't like the Dead's music, why should they stay tuned to this show?
Well, I've always said that you don't have to like the Dead's music to love their story. In many ways, it's a long, complicated story with a lot of moving parts. And what I found in researching it is that you could really figure out as much as you wanted to about a kind of alternative voice and an alternative strain of American culture, not just in the 60s, but also in the second half of the 20th century.
And you write that your own interest in the Dead doesn't follow the usual track. Your brother was a big fan, but you really weren't when you were growing up in the 60s.
Not so much. I mean, my brother had all the albums. We listened to the music a lot in the house, but anybody who has an older sibling knows that, you know, if you didn't go out and choose that music, but you're familiar with it, it's a different kind of relationship to the music. So their music became the kind of sonic wallpaper for our house, but I didn't really give it that much thought until a few years ago. And I realized that so much of this material fit very well into a course that I teach at San Francisco State University. And then one thing led to another, and pretty soon I was, you know, knee-deep in a 3 or 4 year reading and writing project.
And you talk to your students about the Dead, and most of them don't really have much knowledge of the Dead.
Almost none, actually. I mean, don't forget, the band stopped performing in 1995. Most of my students are, you know, born at that time or later. And there's really no reason for them to know that much about them. But I find that when I introduce the material and set it in its time and place, there's a great deal of interest in the Dead and their story.
You talk about submitting a conference paper to the Grateful Dead Scholars Caucus, which you began attending in 2011. And you said that the panels there resembled an academic version of a Dead concert, communal, uneven, full of peak moments. As for camaraderie, the caucus easily eclipsed anything I had experienced in my academic life. And it helped me identify and explore my interest in the Dead and their history. This really stood out for me because I know you, and you've done so much amazing work about the politics and the culture of the 60s. So for you to say that this really stood out for you is pretty significant.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in many ways, this Grateful Dead Scholars Caucus, which is now being run by Nicholas Merriweather, who's the Grateful Dead archivist at the University of California, Santa Cruz, which is an incredible resource for those interested in the Dead and their story. This caucus is the friendliest, coolest little community. I mean, they've obviously taken some of the principles that the Dead nourished in building their own community of fans and sort of migrated it over into the academic space. And that's a conscious project that everybody there is working on. It makes a big difference in the mood and the temper of these conferences, with a full slate of social activities I probably don't even have to mention that. And in every way, it's an incredibly supportive community.
So you ask a very simple question in this book, because there's so much literature and documentaries on the dead. But your question is why? Why, after all of these years, are the dead so popular? And just a couple days before your book was released, the dead announced, the four remaining members announced plans to play in July in Chicago. And we were just talking before the show that so far, 60,000 people have sent envelopes requesting over 350,000 tickets. There's no possible way all these people are going to go. 44,000 hotel rooms are already booked in Chicago. So you feel like the literature that you've already read doesn't really answer that question? Why are the dead still so popular today?
I think you can piece it together. I mean, there's a short shelf of memoirs that I read eagerly and enjoyed. There have been some excellent histories. There's been a great biography of Jerry Garcia. And so I really wanted to focus on what my unique contribution could be. And I felt like it was that interpretive question, the why. I don't think you have to explain it to deadheads, although I asked a lot of them and a lot of other people, too, including people like Jan Wenner. Well, you know, why do you think the dead were so successful for so long? I mean, don't forget, many of their peers who were at least as popular as the Dead's, in many cases were selling more albums like Jefferson Airplane. I mean, they sort of flashed across the American scene, whereas the Dead kept chugging on decade after decade. They were being written off as a nostalgia act in the 1970s. Little did anyone know that some of their best years, certainly in terms of their touring, would be in the early 90s. So I think it's a question that requires a little bit more study and also some interviewing. I went out and asked these people and got a lot of great answers, then tried to drill down and come up with three or four things that had some explanatory power.
You have some really good quotes in the book, and I'll read some throughout the hour. But what did you hear from deadheads? Was there much? Did people give you different answers? Were they all on the same theme?
Well, one thing that I got consistently from deadheads, especially the people that experienced the earliest concerts here in San Francisco mostly, was this incredible emphasis on intense experience. You know, that being there was an incredibly important part of the story, and that there was something not only utopian but kind of tribal about those early experiences. And some of these people form friendships, very close friendships, that have sustained them through their entire adult lives. And so that was a testimony to the kind of community aspect that you mentioned at the top of the show. But also there was another theme that I think is really important, and that was the Dead's emphasis and the community's emphasis on ecstasy. You know, not the drug, but that experience of total rapture that a lot of people want in their lives and that they couldn't or weren't finding in other ways. And to have that feeling in a like-minded community and supportive community, this is very important to people. And you know, over and above the music, and there's a lot to say about the music, mm-hmm. but quite aside from the music, this sense of rapture, this sense of adventure, especially going out on the road, and then to do that in community, I think was really, really important to the people that I talked to.
I loved reading about the history of San Francisco, from the politics to where the posters at the Fillmore come from. So often when you go to concerts at the Fillmore, you get a free poster. I just saw Patti Smith on Saturday. Amazing show, and we got a poster. So you have all these cool details in your book. And as someone who's written about ramparts, and you've spent so much time really studying the history of Northern California during the 50s and 60s, doing research for the Dead, what did you learn?
Well, I learned that a major part of their project was formed not in the 60s, but actually in the 1950s, the more the beat scene than the hippie scene, although, of course, the two scenes were related, especially here in San Francisco. And one of the things I discovered in doing research on Jerry Garcia, for example, is that many of the key aspects of the Dead's project, which was always collaborative, it wasn't just about Jerry Garcia, but the outlines of the Dead's project were shaped in large part between his 15th and 16th birthdays. That was around 1958. And that was the year that he signed up for art classes at what's now the San Francisco Art Institute. His his teacher, Wally Hedrick, there turned him on to Jack Kerouac and On the Road, which he loved, and had difficulty later separating from his own sense of himself as an artist. He also received his first electric guitar, actually an accordion, which he traded in for a guitar. He got that on his 15th birthday. And he smoked marijuana for the first time during that year. And, you know, a lot of people did those things, all four of those things. But I think when you look at the San Francisco at that time, what was going on, both in San Francisco, but also, you know, the Cold War and what was happening nationally, and this intense need for a vital artistic community, and the artistic community that Jerry Garcia discovered over at what's now the San Francisco Art Institute, he never went back. And you can see why. I mean, it must have been very appealing to someone who was looking for more and found it in this small but very vital arts community in San Francisco.
I'm speaking with Peter Richardson about his new book, No Simple Highway, A Cultural History of the Grateful Dead. Peter will be speaking on January 28th, that's tomorrow, Book Passage in Corte Madera. What time is that, Peter? The event page missed the time.
I want to say it's 7 p.m.
7 p.m., okay. And you can find information about Peter's events at yourcallradio.org. And Peter takes a look at the history of the Grateful Dead, and he asks a very simple question. Why? What explains the Grateful Dead's durable popularity? If you have any comments on this, if you followed the Dead, if you like the Dead's music or consider yourself a Deadhead, what attracts you to the band? And why do you think 30 years later, well, 20 years after their last concert, they just announced new concerts in July. 44,000 hotel rooms have already been sold in Chicago. So what do you think explains this continued appeal? Peter points out that a lot of the really great bands that formed back then are really not popular anymore. People listen to their albums, but they don't get as much attention as the Dead. Give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. I have a funny Facebook question from Jason. Actually, it's a comment. He says, I posted what explains the Dead's popularity. He said, it confounds me. I got to hear this. So what would you say to people who just don't get it?
Well, a lot of critics didn't get it. And I think one thing that it's important to understand is that the focus on community gave the Dead a lot of artistic freedom. They never turned into a nostalgia act, just playing their old hits over and over again. What forming the community allowed them to do is to continue to develop and evolve musically. They tried a lot of new things, different things over time. And, you know, not all of those things worked. And one of the things that they were very committed to was improvisation, not just one person improvising on top of the band, but everybody improvising at the same time. And when that worked, that was magic. It didn't always work. So some people could hear the Grateful Dead on an off night or hear a tape, you know, in their dorm room 25 years ago and just dismiss this band. But I think they may be missing out on something important. And even the critics missed that. I don't think the critics understood that in large part what these concerts were an occasion for the community to commune. And, you know, that community aspect was a really important part of their ongoing success, and especially their durability. And much of their success came very late in the game. I mean, they didn't have a top 10 hit, a top 10 single, until they, you know, until the late 80s. They'd already been around for over 20 years. And this was well after, you know, the high 60s period, which is what they're associated with. So there's a lot of different things happening, but I think one of the main things is this sense of community that they fostered and a lot of other bands didn't. I mean, did Bob Dylan care about community? I don't think so. He barely talks to the musicians he performs with. So, you know, there was this attitude right from the start that can be traced directly back to the acid tests and the Fillmore shows very early on in the 1960s. I mean, we heard the Beatles on this station just before this. And in 1966, the Beatles were still running out on stage in identical suits, performing eight songs in 30 minutes and then running off, you know, with people screaming. The Dead and their friends were doing something very different right across town. that became what we know as the modern rock concert, with light shows and freestyle dancing and long jams. And so it was a very different sort of experience, and the Dead were pioneers in developing it.
And you can hear the interview about the Beatles and hear these really great songs on Fresh Air today with Terry Gross. You write about this in your book, that the Dead were heavily influenced by the Beatles. You quote Bob Weir as saying, "The Beatles were why we turned from a jug band into a rock and roll band. What we saw them doing was impossibly attractive. I couldn't think of anything else more worth doing."
Right. Yeah, they were. I mean, the British Invasion and the Beatles in particular were a huge influence on the Dead. They had been folkies, essentially, to that moment, many of them. And almost immediately they decided this is where the energy was, and it was time to become an electric blues band. And it wasn't just the music either. They didn't try to imitate that music in any way. Their influences and kind of musical streams were a little bit different, overlapped a little bit with the Beatles, but were quite different. But the films that the movies did were also, they were having fun. And I think the Dead thought, hey, you know, that looks like a lot of fun. Let's try that.
You quote Jerry Garcia saying, "The movies were a big turn-on. They were making people happy. That happy thing, that's the stuff that counts, was something we could all see right away."
Yeah. And, you know, Garcia was a big film buff, too, in addition to being interested in the visual arts and so on. So those films, Phil Lesh talks in his memoir about going to see the film with, you know, a few dozen teenage girls. I think he saw the film over in the Tenderloin somewhere. And he just said, as soon as I got out of that theater, I went home and just combed my hair forward over my forehead. And I was converted immediately.
Peter Richardson is author of the new book, No Simple Highway, A Cultural History of the Grateful Dead. And he asks a very simple question. Why? Why are the Dead still so popular? The band will convene nearly 20 years to the day of their last concert at Chicago's Soldier Field over 4th of July. 44,000 hotel rooms have already been booked in Chicago. So what do you think explains this continued appeal? If you don't get it, we'd also love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you'd like to talk about any memories about what it was like in the Bay Area and San Francisco in terms of culture and arts and politics at that time, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Jazzy in San Francisco. Hi, Jazzy. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thank you very much. Yeah, I think I just wanted to comment on, I think you put it perfectly. I'm only 20, you know, I wasn't here 50 years ago when they were playing their shows at the Fillmore West and all of that, but I think it lives on in the community and the jam bands today and in the bluegrass scene. There's just a sense of community and family. And I think in having that, it's so appealing, especially to my generation. You know, whatever you need, someone's willing to help you out. And I think you put it perfectly. It's very tribal.
I think Jazzy's exactly right, actually. And it reminds me of an interview I did with Rolling Stone founder Jan Wenner, who was writing about the Grateful Dead. Actually, the Dead appeared in the very first issue of Rolling Stone magazine after a drug bust at their home on 710 Ashbury. But I asked Jan, why, you know, what do you think? Why do you think the Dead were so successful for so long? And he came back immediately with a two-word answer: family values. Which is an interesting spin on all the reasons we're not supposed to like the Grateful Dead, what that phrase has meant in American politics over the years. But that sense of support and community and kindness, really, within that community is a huge feature of the Grateful Dead experience.
Well, thank you for calling in, Jazzy. Let's go next to Anthony in Oakland. Hi, Anthony. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hey. Thanks for taking my call. Great program.
Thank you.
Love the Dead. Saw them over 100 times from 1986 to 1995. And, you know, I think you're right. Community is super important to what made them so important. But I feel like, especially with these Chicago shows, they've made statements that this is the final time they will ever play together. It seems like the community is all out there, and maybe this was always the point and always the case, is that we are the community, and they're just kind of basically really struggling to be in the same room together these days, which is kind of, I don't know, it's a weird dark mirror reflection of what their music really should all be about. I'm wondering if your author has any comments on that.
Thanks, Anthony. I've heard some rumors too. I think it probably was pretty hard to put this show together. These are people that have their own lives and haven't been performing together very often. I think the last time they all performed together was at an inauguration ball for President Obama in 2009. So it's not often that they get together and play together, though I've seen two or more of them together very frequently, even recently, especially here in the San Francisco Bay Area. I don't think it's easy, and I think part of it was, I think in many ways, the absence of Jerry Garcia makes some of this work harder and harder. Not that he was the glue that held the whole thing together, but Robert Hunter used to say about the Grateful Dead, the lyricist Robert Hunter, who was the Dead's key lyricist, used to say that the entire organization was a reflection of Jerry Garcia's mind. And without Jerry Garcia, it might be harder than it might otherwise be to sort of pull people together and provide a little leadership. He was not eager to assume that leadership role. He didn't really like conflict. He didn't love being the person that made any kind of final decisions. They ran their organization more or less democratically, and which is another interesting aspect of their operation. He was amazed that Mick Jagger made all the important decisions for the Rolling Stones. He was flabbergasted by that. But there it is. I mean, I don't want to point to that one thing, but I think that probably does figure in some of the difficulty that they've had over the years coming to agreement about what to do, when to do it, how to do it.
Have you interviewed any of them?
No, it's been hard. They've been interviewed up one side and down the other. I mean, I went to the Grateful Dead archive and read hundreds of interviews that they've already done. And in some ways, I found those very useful for my project, which was to situate them, historically. I tried the way a lot of people try, but these are rock stars and they have their own.
You should go sit next to Phil Lesh's table at Terrapin Crossroads.
I have seen him there. I did wave to him once there.
He's there all the time.
I know. Eating some pasta and enjoying his two sons and their play. I've been there a lot. I really love it. Sweetwater's another great venue. And I've seen most of these bands in one form or another. In fact, I write about going to see a further show. At the very end of the book, I talk a little bit about what that was like. Blair Jackson compared that show to the closest thing he'd seen to a real Grateful Dead show since 1995. So, there's still rolling. There's tensions. I will say, and I think this is really important when we're talking about their durability, they were really good about not slamming each other publicly. Whatever their tensions were inside the band, they never embarrassed each other publicly. And sometimes that can do in a band very quickly. And, many of their peers, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and, Jefferson Airplane and others have really struggled with those kinds of tensions. The Dead took a hiatus in the 1970s, but realized, this is really what we want to do. And they came back and did it until 1995.
Peter Richardson is author of the new book, No Simple Highway, A Cultural History of the Grateful Dead. Peter teaches humanities and American studies at San Francisco State, and he asks a simple question. Why? Why are the Dead still so popular? For almost three decades, they were America's most popular touring band. They'll reconvene 20 years to the day of the last concert they played at Chicago's Soldier Field over the 4th of July. So why do you think the Dead are still so popular today? What questions do you have about the Grateful Dead? And if you have any stories, we'd love to hear from you. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, a program that relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling toll-free 866-798-TALK, 866-798-TALK. 8255. You can send your email question or comment, if you like, to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, the BBC's World Have Your Say, and at noon today, it's Philosophy Talk.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll continue our series on police, community, race, and justice by talking about how unconscious racial bias affects police and community relations. Even those of us who believe in equality and fairness show significant patterns of bias. So how are police departments dealing with this? Can officers be trained to recognize their bias and alter their behavior? And what is the most effective way to combat implicit bias? That's tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we will be talking about transparency about tuition in the UC system. There's a lot of tension right now between Governor Jerry Brown and UC head Janet Napolitano. So we'll talk about why this process isn't more transparent and what can be done to make UC more affordable for students. That's Thursday. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today I'm joined by Peter Richardson, author of the new book, No Simple Highway, A Cultural History of the Grateful Dead. Peter's also author of A Bomb in Every Issue, which recounts the rise and fall of Ramparts magazine. Peter will be speaking at Book Passage in Corte Madera on January 28th, tomorrow at 7 p.m., and then at Copperfield in Sebastopol on February 20th, also at 7 p.m. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to share a story about the Grateful Dead, if you have any questions about why they're still so popular, if you just don't get it, we'd love to also hear from you at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And let's go next to Jonathan in San Francisco. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, good morning to you, Rose.
Hi, go ahead, you're on the air.
Okay, first of all, thank you very much for this program. And Peter, obviously I haven't read your book yet, but I want to thank you for taking the time and devoting the energy to it that you did. I already ordered my signed copy, and I'll pick it up tomorrow night at Book Passage when I get to see you speak.
Thanks so much for your support. I mean, we've been delighted with the reception for this book. I mean, obviously the timing turned out to be very fortuitous, but there's a deep reservoir of goodwill and interest in the band, and it's really been a joy working on this project and meeting people all along the way.
Jonathan?
I imagine you follow in the footsteps of some truly terrific writers as far as Steve Silverman and Blair, all these friends of mine. I want to say that I got into the Dead in the late 70s, and I actually became one of their larger merchandisers. My company was Grateful Graphics, and I was the first to merchandise the Dancing Bears for the band and developed a very big business, but at its core was the music for me. And I think that was something that confused quite a few people, because it was never about making money. It was not a venture for capitalism. It was truly just an effort for me to sustain myself on tour that I had the good fortune of developing into a very lucrative business. I will say that what more than anything seemed to attract me to the band was what decades later Seth Godin refers to as our staying with our tribe. And they were really the precursor to all of that, insofar as I knew that without the use of social media or my cell phone, which was, of course, developed long after the Dead stopped playing, I knew that I could go to shows anywhere in the country or around the world and always run into my people and have the sense of community and family and familiarity and love. And toward that end, when I heard that Jerry passed, I've never cried harder and felt longing more than that. And I'm forever grateful to just have had the experiences that I did.
I think your experience would be seconded by so many people that I've talked to, and also your points. I mean, one of the things about the economic aspects of the Dead and their journey is that they really wanted to create a kind of hip economy that would support not only themselves but also their whole scene, and they put a lot of energy into that, and they got a lot of great energy back because of that. I mean, if you ever want to see some great art, you should just see the decorated envelopes that the Grateful Dead office got with requests for tickets and so on. In fact, a whole book was made just out of that beautiful art, and that continues to come in. I think you mentioned social media also. I mean, the Deadheads were early adopters of different forms of social media. A lot of Dead fans continue to connect and exchange information on The Well, for example. The Well was founded by Stuart Brand. I talk a little bit about this in the book. Brand was a merry prankster with Ken Kesey. He also was a co-organizer of the TRIPS Festival. And this emphasis on community and tribalism, I feel that you can trace a direct line from the TRIPS Festival, for example, through The Well and social media, and then directly to, for example, a community like Burning Man. Not that the dead influence Burning Man, but I think both the Burning Man culture and the dead culture could be traced back to a common source of the mid-century San Francisco art scene, which really emphasized improvisation, spontaneity, radical inclusion, and also the whole notion of it's all show and no spectators. The dead worked really hard to weaken that distinction between the talent and the audience. And the audience really responded to that. The audience always completed a Grateful Dead show in a really important way, and that's not always true.
Hmm. Since he brought up the music industry, can you talk a little bit about how the Dead tried to revolutionize the industry? In 1972, Jerry Garcia said, quote, "What we've been trying to do is liberate the music industry, or at least our little part of it, by gradually withdrawing from record companies, gradually withdrawing from the whole scene until we finally have control over the whole range of things we're doing," end quote.
Yeah, and that attitude, too, I think you can trace back to the mid-century San Francisco art scene. I mean, this was a very isolated scene, and so they were always in the position of having to make their own party. And the Dead embraced that. David Ganz has pointed out that the Dead really invented every aspect of their operation. I mean, they created their own instruments. They created their own sound system. They created their own label. I mean, they didn't just have a label within a broader music company. It was their venture. Now they gave up on that. They were spending too much time on the business side and not enough side on the creative time. But they tried it, and I think that says a lot about what their goals were and what their aspirations were, and just their willingness to say, "Let's try doing it the way we want to do it and see what happens." And that emboldened a lot of other people. And now it's, you know, that tour heavy business model is really the norm in the music business, for reasons that have to do with changes in the way music gets produced and distributed and consumed. But I think a lot of musicians now are going back and saying, hey, let's try to connect with our fans at that level and see what we can learn from the Grateful Dead and their operation.
That would be a great show, actually. All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Jonathan. Let's go next to Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry.
Hi, good morning, Rose. I just wanted to say I don't think as a musical unit, the Grateful Dead have ever been that compelling to me. I think that Robert Hunter, the lyricist, he penned a lot of, you know, beautiful songs, and I don't think he gets as much credit as he deserves. The one really interesting performer they had, Pigpen, self-destructed in a similar way. I think the tune Casey Jones also may have encouraged people to use cocaine, because it certainly glorified it in a way. And as you know, those people go on to ruin their lives either through cocaine or onto crack cocaine. And I understand the Dead themselves suffered from drug abuse, and they are also extremely materialistic. And everything that's sort of wrong with this generation, as is Burning Man, it's all about me, me, me. It's not really about dealing with the social problems in the society or giving back, because these people that go to work at Walmart and work for low-wage jobs or whatever, they save up their money to go to Grateful Dead show, but I don't see the Grateful Dead with all their millions giving much back, or maybe I'm just not properly informed about that.
Well, thank you. So you brought up two really interesting points, drugs and sort of politics, and whether or not the Dead, and I'd love to talk with you about this, the Dead and fans were socially involved. And so do you want to first talk about drugs?
Sure. But even before that, I'd like to second the idea that Robert Hunter was a very, very important part of the Dead success. I mean, the lyrics are really at a different level than most rock lyrics that you hear. He was really probably closer in that way to somebody like Bob Dylan than he is to a lot of his other peers. Also, Pigpen. I mean, Pigpen, interestingly, was the guy who wasn't using drugs, but he was a very heavy drinker and died at age 27 of causes that were related to his drinking. Casey Jones, too, if you look at the lyrics, it's really an anti-drug song. They were really trying, I talk about this in the book, they were really trying to put together a railroad song. There are many that they were big fans of, going back to the folk tradition. Also, railroad songs and cocaine songs was part of that same music stream, and they wanted to add a good song to that tradition. But they did admit later that even in trying to warn against cocaine and its abuse, it put it on the radar for more people, and they did abuse cocaine from time to time, especially from time to time, pretty regularly throughout the 70s. So it was an important part of their history in a way that is not so glamorous. Mostly they wanted to get high through music. I mean, the drugs were part of it. And don't forget, LSD was legal when the Grateful Dead started using it and when they were playing at these acid tests, the early ones anyway. And so, you know, drugs are an important part. And I try to place the Grateful Dead story against a larger backdrop, especially starting in 1972 with the war on drugs. I mean, it's easy enough to focus on the Grateful Dead and drug use. But I also think you have to consider, you know, the war on drugs and the militarization of that war on drugs. And I look at some of the Dead's appeal, especially in the 1980s, as a kind of response to that war on drugs. I mean, the Dead were never more popular than when Ronald Reagan was in power, both as the governor of California and then again as president of the United States. And their biggest successes, commercially anyway, came when Reagan was in power and was telling young people to just say no. A lot of people thought that meant say no, you know, to a lot of other things besides drugs. Say no to critical thinking, say no to adventure, and other things that the Dead stood for, along with that kind of drive for ecstatic rapture. So, and on the political side, it's very easy to get this wrong, and I wanted to be really careful about it in my book. I'm very interested in politics, and I spent a lot of time thinking about the Dead's comments on that, and I'd love to get into that in more depth.
So, yes, because I found this really great part of your book. You write about Reagan's national push to ban LSD. It's really easy to forget that LSD was legal at one point, and this was the spring of 1966, 1 month before California's gubernatorial election, the state outlawed the possession and the use of LSD. The same day, the Dead played the Love Pageant rally in the panhandle of Golden Gate Park, where hundreds of hippies protested the new law by dropping acid together.
Right. Yeah. They believed in this. And of course, this goes back to Hunter again. I mean, Hunter, like Ken Kesey, was one of the people who was a test subject down on the peninsula when the VA and Stanford Hospital were dosing people to figure out if there was a way to weaponize LSD, either by spraying it or spiking water supplies and pacifying, you know, enemy populations. So, I mean, really the development and most of the research around LSD in the 50s and early 60s was conducted both by the military and by the CIA. So, I mean, it's this crazy story, really, that the Pentagon actually, in some ways, developed this research that ignited the 1960s counterculture. It's very paradoxical. And the Dead were right in the middle of that. Of course, they were still in Palo Alto at that time. Robert Hunter was a test subject himself. Ken Kesey was another one. And, you know, the first pages of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest are a direct outgrowth of his experience as a drug test subject.
You write that Jerry Garcia said the Dead saw themselves as signposts to new space, not political activists or social engineers. Like many of their heroes and peers, the Dead rarely commented on politics as such. And though they played scores of benefits for various causes, they were consistently and pointedly uninterested in speeches, elections, and most forms of conventional political activity. Jerry Garcia cast his last vote in 1964, and 8 years later, the Dead declined to help George McGovern's presidential campaign after the Democratic nominee balked at their suggestion to legalize marijuana.
Right. Yeah, they stayed away from direct comments on most forms of electoral politics. But I don't think you can really understand their success apart from the political and social energies that were kind of swirling around them. I don't blame them for not talking about that. I mean, they were asked about politics constantly, and because it was an intensely political time. And they seemed to be leaders of the counterculture, and so people wanted to know what they thought about Vietnam and everything else. And I think, I don't have any direct evidence for this, but in some ways I think Jerry Garcia knew that if he went down that road in these interviews, that he was going to have a hard time coming back to the thing that he really cared about, which was getting high through music. And I think, that's hard for a lot of political people to understand, that not everybody thinks that politics is kind of the ultimate horizon of human experience and everything else somehow should serve that.
But what they were doing is living the life, their version of utopia, and that's what they wanted for the future of the country.
Absolutely.
So that was kind of their political statement in a way.
It was.
Right?
It was, yeah. And I mean, I would never say that they weren't political. I mean, I just think that there was more nuance and subtlety there. I mean, one thing that their newsletter said in the summer of 1966, they started putting out a newsletter. This was their most ecstatic summer in many ways. It was at Rancho Olampali in Marin County, where they just partied and skinny dipped and jammed and invited their friends. And it was a really wonderful summer for them. They waxed eloquent about it for many years afterwards. But one of the things that came out in the newsletter, the Grateful Dead newsletter at that time, was that they were ignoring politics to death. I mean, this was the year that Ronald Reagan would become governor of California. That wasn't their project. I mean, they had to make some decisions about what they would be in their repertoire, and ongoing political commentary was not one of those things. Now, Jerry Garcia did make an exception for Reagan, especially in the 1980s, and they were always very outspoken on environmental issues. And you can go through that and pick those out. And mostly their politics were revealed, I think, in the kinds of organizations that they supported. They did a lot of philanthropy, continue to do a lot of philanthropy through the Rex Foundation.
What did they say about environmental issues?
Very early on, they were worried about, ecological destruction. And Garcia made a number of comments about that was the one thing that would be more important and more abiding and more consequential than party politics. He never quite put it that way, but I think that was the implication.
You mentioned the Dead's first newsletter, which appeared in March 1967. It said, "We inherited the evil and wars, but chose to ignore them to death rather than try to kill off everyone else who does not see utopia as we do. The movement of joy is spreading, and we are glad to be part of it."
Yeah. I think that's an interesting summation, I think, of their position. And they never strayed too far away from that, though I mentioned that they played President Obama's inauguration and so on. I mean, it was a very fluid sort of situation, and they did come out for legalization of marijuana very early. They were arrested for that in October of 1967 for possession. Interestingly, one of the person who wrote their press release turned out to be Harry Shearer of NPR fame, and whose show I think airs here on KLW.
Yeah, Le Show.
And he was a friend of Danny Rifkin's, who was the manager of the Grateful Dead at that time. So it's a really interesting part of their story to see how they manage that. But I think for the most part, they massaged it. And one of the things I explore in the book is that in that sense, they were very similar to another hugely popular touring act but in 19th century America, and that was Buffalo Bill's Wild West. I mean, Buffalo Bill's father was basically hounded to death by pro-slavers. During the Civil War and in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War. That was a very divisive issue. It was a very tumultuous time in American history. And what Buffalo Bill did, very much like the Grateful Dead, is that he put together a kind of touring, miniature world that he could bring to your city. And it was full of kind of politically vague American symbolism. And I think the Dead in many ways did the same thing.
I'm speaking today with Peter Richardson about his new book, No Simple Highway, A Cultural History of the Grateful Dead. Peter will be speaking tomorrow night at Book Passage in Corte Madera at 7 o'clock. You can find information at yourcallradio.org. I want to read just a couple emails, and then we'll get to a few more calls. Robert says, I was exposed to the culture in Oakland in 1985 and fell in love with how nice everyone was and how we shared. Thank you for that. And I have another email from Joe. I was not really into the Dead, and then I went to a couple of shows with a lover of mine who was a longtime Deadhead, and I found it to be really sweet. It was all about the scene, the space in which everyone got high together and smiled and asked to be miracled and hung out in the parking lot. There were also lots of political tables in the venue for forest defenders, etc., where everybody could connect. It wasn't my scene, she writes. I had no compulsions to go back and had to leave once the creepy space stuff started, but after I attended, I got why people were so religious about it.
It's interesting that Joe mentions religion, because one of the things that the Dead were suspected of was running a kind of cult, which was a very serious matter in the late 70s. I mean, don't forget, this was the period of Jonestown here in San Francisco, and also the Unification Church and the Moonies. To be called a cult was in no way a compliment, and the mainstream media called the Grateful Dead and their followers a cult all the time, at a time when it was, you know, a very important thing to say about somebody, and again, not in any way flattering. So they struggled with that label a little bit. The religious dimension and the Dead did invite that kind of discussion, because for them there was a kind of spiritual dimension, if not a religious one. Robert Hunter and John Perry Barlow, the key lyricist, said, "Let's not try to write, you know, a kind of dogma for this religion." Because people would over respond probably, and Jerry Garcia didn't even talk on stage because he was worried that people would read in all this kind of spiritual meaning to the things he was saying. Hmm. So they walked up to that line, and they understood that there was a kind of religious dimension to what they were doing, almost a kind of sacramental dimension to what they were doing, but they were very clear about not crossing that line into some sort of cult behavior.
Is this something they talked about often behind the scenes?
A fair amount, yeah. I mean, you can see this in their interviews. You can see this in different kinds of... I mean, Robert Greenfield's book, Dark Star, which is an autobiography of Jerry Garcia, goes into this a little bit. Dennis McNally's book. Of course, Dennis was the publicist. He also had a PhD in American history and wrote the best-selling history of the band. And Blair Jackson's biography of Jerry Garcia. Most of them touch on some aspect of this, yeah.
Well, thank you for the emails. Let's go next to Barbara in Carmel Valley. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for taking my call. I love your show.
Thank you.
I was calling to speak to the why. From a strictly musical aspect, one of the things that the Grateful Dead did that no other band did was you could see them three nights in a row and not hear the same song. They kept it fresh. They fed off of the audience. Unlike, you know, you go to a Rolling Stones concert, you see the same exact show every night, maybe a one or two song variation, but essentially the same 15 songs, you know, for the whole tour, which is boring. The Grateful Dead was never boring.
That's exactly right, Barbara. I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, that's a super important point. If you're going to travel with a band and see them three nights in a row or maybe more, you don't want to hear the same thing. You know, you don't want to hear a recital, the same recital every night. That's not going to work. And because the Dead were committed to that improvisation, because they never had a set list, or most of the time they didn't have a set list, sometimes they didn't know what they were going to play. So that was important for keeping the community interested in their music, I think, and committed, and keeping them committed to that improvisation. One of the earlier callers mentioned drums in space, which was incredibly open improvisation, not always that popular, but it was maybe the most distinctive aspect of that improvisation, and those signature jams that for the real aficionados are what, that's what kept them coming back. The studio albums, even the really popular ones like Working Man's Dead and American Beauty, which produced a lot of classic tunes, You know, those are good too. And for a lot of listeners, that's their favorite part of the band's music. But most of the more committed fans were more interested in the improvisation.
Do you find that their musical abilities get lost when you look at the history of the Grateful Dead?
A little bit. I mean, you know, they were. I mean, when they first started, they were still learning their instruments. I mean, Phil Lesh was trained as a trumpeter, a jazz trumpeter, and Jerry Garcia just handed him a bass and said, "Here, we want you to play this now." So you know, they had to work all that out, and they had all these gigs on these divorcee bars down on the peninsula where they, you know, most of the time they were clearing those places out for years while they were learning their craft. But Garcia especially, who had grown up with folk music and had played the banjo, had a very distinctive, instantly recognizable style. And most people credit his guitar work and Phil Lesh's bass work also. Very unusual and distinctive. Not everybody endorsed it, but there was no doubt who you were listening to.
We have about a minute left, Peter. Final thoughts?
I'm just so happy that all of this is happening right now. I mean, the announcement of this tour or this last stand at Soldier Field and the popularity is just kind of a proof of something that I've been trying to tell people all along, which is that there's this large, cohesive, dedicated community that's still going on and still kind of growing in many ways, even 20 years after the Dead have left the scene, that they've left this huge legacy, not only musically, but just in the way they present themselves to their fans, the way they run their organization, the way they treat their fans, and, you know, the way they kept it rolling. Huge, interesting, complicated story.
Peter Richardson is author of the new book, No Simple Highway, A Cultural History of the Grateful Dead. Peter will be speaking tomorrow night at Book Passage in Corte Madera at 7 o'clock. Find information at yourcallradio.org. Peter, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What role does implicit bias play in policing? On the next Your Call, we'll continue our series on police, community, race, and justice by talking about how unconscious racial bias affects police and community relations. Even those of us who believe in equality and fairness show significant patterns of bias. So how are police departments dealing with this? Can officers be trained to recognize their bias and alter their behavior? And what's the most effective way to deal with this? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Nock Nguyen produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. And Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.